I should like to assure you, dear friends, that this review of my own book will be a very favorable one. I have been asked why I chose to write a book on Moses. Well, ever since my student days, I have always stood in reverent admiration before this spiritual giant. I've always regarded him as the foremost pioneer in the realm of religion, whose revolutionary insights and teachings were in the nature of a spiritual breakthrough for mankind and ushered in a new era in the spiritual development of the human race. And then I've always been somewhat resentful of the manner in which some historians of religion and so-called higher biblical critics have relegated this man Moses to a sort of a vague, legendary periphery out there somewhere in the history of religion. He lived so long ago, they argued, more than 3,000 years ago, that advanced ethical teachings and doctrines could not possibly be ascribed to him. Whatever he taught, if anything, must of necessity have been rudimentary, imperfectly developed. And whatever there is exalted in his teaching must be the product of a later age. Now, these historians of religion and theologians have applied, knowingly or unknowingly, the doctrine of evolution to man's spiritual life in the same way as it is applied to all organic life. But this parallel is quite unwarranted. What is intrinsically exalted in man's spiritual life does not necessarily come late in time. As often as not, as it was projected very early by some extraordinary spiritual personality, by some man of genius. And his age may not have been ready for him at all. But his teachings outlived his age. It is futile to attempt to trace the development of a religious culture to impersonal forces or to apply evolutionistic processes and judgments to it. It is often the fortuitous appearance of a forceful personality possessed of a new idea which gives new substance, a new direction to a people's religious life. And no one can explain how or why it happened. It is one of the unaccountable accidents in the spiritual and intellectual history of the human race. Moses was not a product of his age. He did not borrow his revolutionary ideas from his environment. Just how he came to entertain his ideas is no greater mystery than the radical insights which come to all men of genius. The appearance of any great personality in history is unpredictable, and his endowments are inexplicable. He leaps into his age unexpectedly, like lightning out of darkness. And his generation may grant him or deny him scope and opportunity. To be sure, such a man does not operate in a vacuum. But whatever truth he reveals wells up in his own soul with the force of an immediate and overpowering apprehension. Whatever he conceives of, intellectually or spiritually, is a new act of creation and is his very own. Now, some scholars have maintained that it was not really Moses who was responsible for the great ethical teachings which are found in the Torah, the Bible, but the later prophets. These scholars trace the beginnings of spiritual Judaism to the literary prophets of the 8th through the 6th century before the Common Era. 500 or 600 years after the time of Moses. Prior to that time, this 8th or 6th century, these scholars maintain the religion of Israel was little different from the religions of all its heathen neighbors. It was these literary prophets, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Jeremiah, etc., it was these literary prophets who introduced new concepts of religion and ethics, radical new departures in ways of thinking about God and of worshiping him. There are even those scholars who maintain that Judaism actually began with the great reformation of King Josiah around 621 before the Common Era. Now, nothing can be further from the truth. It was not the prophets of Israel from Amos down, nor the earlier non-literary prophets like Samuel, Nathan, and Gad, and Elijah. It wasn't these who created the religion of Israel. They would have been the last to make any such claims. They never conceived of themselves as innovators or originators of the ideas which they proclaimed. They regarded themselves as having been sent to remind the people of what they had forgotten, to recall them to a faith and a way of life which their ancestors had chosen to adopt, but which their descendants had chosen to ignore. The Navi, the prophet, was in very truth a mochiach bashar, one who reproves in the gate where the people would assemble. He was the man who reproved them in the gate. He summoned the nation to repentance for sins committed against the moral laws which were very well known to them. The prophet Jeremiah clearly defined the mission of the prophet. When God brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, he gave them this command, said Jeremiah, "Obey my voice, and I will be your God." But they did not obey. Whereupon God sent them time and again his servants, the prophets. Yet they did not listen to them and did not obey the voice of God. They did not accept musar, that is correction. The function of the prophet was to bring musar, a call to repentance, a call to correction to the people. The prophets did speak with authority, with the authority of inspiration, but always as the restorers of the true and ancient faith to a generation that had ignored or forgotten it. There was something new in the teachings of the later prophets. What was new in their preaching was the extraordinary earnestness and passionate intensity with which they uttered their warning, their correction, their musar. Theirs was a spiritual and ethical fervor utterly unknown in the ancient world. And while in their restatement, of the centuries-old teachings and parables of their faith, they did not add anything new to the original Torah. They elaborated upon it. They plumbed its very depths. They applied it to their times with force, uncompromising frankness, and impartiality. And there is genuine originality in such rare and consecrated discipleship. It's not merely the leader who is original. The disciple, by interpreting the teachings of the leader, is original. And what was also substantially new in the teachings of these later prophets concerned the future, the Acharit HaYamim, the end of days. Beyond the present, they projected a vision of distant times when all the nations of the earth shall acknowledge Yahweh Adonai as their God and would live by his law. They saw all men and nations reconciled at last in a universal brotherhood of peace. They entertained the hope that Israel, first born to the idea of the one universal spiritual God, might serve as a light to the nations, guiding them to a happy consummation of a free, just, and united world community. It was these later prophets who introduced what we call the messianic motif, which was to gain such emphasis in subsequent centuries. In the original Torah of Moses, there is no reference to disarmament or universal peace. One finds in the words of Moses deep concern for the protection of the stranger. You shall love the stranger. But it remained for the literary prophets of the 8th century onward to draw the ultimate implications of the idea of human brotherhood in terms of universal disarmament and of a peaceful society of nations founded upon law. It required centuries of living as a nation among nations for the ethical idea of a warless international community to ripen among the spiritual leaders of Israel. The generation of Moses was as yet far removed from that experience and from that vision. Now, my good friends, what were the great new ideas of Moses, which constitute the core of the Torah Moshe, the Torah of Moses, as we now have it? Well, Moses, of course, taught monotheism, though he did not originate it. Abraham did. The Hebrews had a religious tradition which centered in the worship of one God long before some of them migrated to Egypt. They traced it back to their racial ancestors, to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Even before Abraham left his home in Haran in upper Mesopotamia, northern Mesopotamia, around 1800 before the Common Era, to go to Canaan, his faith and that of his household was basically monotheistic. He worshipped a supreme deity who created heaven and earth, by name of El Elyon, the supreme God, or El Shaddai, the almighty God. It was of this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that Moses spoke to Pharaoh and to the children of Israel. It is to the patriarchs of the Jewish people throughout subsequent ages invariably traced the origin of their faith. Not to Moses or the later prophets. The Bible speaks of the Torah of Moses, but never of the God of Moses. Always as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchok, Elohei Yaakov. Now the religion which Moses gave to his people was not an entirely new religion, but the old religion of the Hebrews to which he gave depth and range and new horizons. With him, the religion of the early Hebrews was transformed into a unique and distinctive faith that differed in some ways from the religion of the patriarchs, and in many ways it differed radically from the religion of all the other nations about them. It is well to remember that the Israelites were the only people in antiquity who had ever been enslaved in a foreign land and had experienced the joy and the quickening of a sudden liberation, and who were now on their way back to their ancestral home. The exploited Egyptian masses, in spite of their wretchedness and serfdom, never in their long history revolted against the existing order. The Israelites had broken with their past, and Moses was resolved to capitalize upon their unique and exhilarating experience and to mold them into a new and different kind of society. These men, these emancipated slaves, could really start fresh. They were truly newborn. Fleeing from Egypt, they were not encumbered by temple and priesthood or royalty. They were no longer chained to ancient laws and immemorial customs. They were, in fact, a classless society that was free to organize its life anew on new patterns. And Moses spelled out the full implications of the worship of this one God of the patriarchs. The God whom the patriarchs called El Elyon or El Shaddai. He spelled out the full implication of this faith in the one God. And to this one God, Moses gave the additional name of Yahweh, Adonai. The Bible clearly states that. I appeared unto your forefathers by the name of El Shaddai, but the name Yahweh, I did not make known unto them, only unto you, unto Moses. Moses gave Yahweh, a God of the patriarchs, a new name, Yahweh. Yahweh means the accomplisher, he who performs and fulfills, he who brings to pass whatever he promises. By freeing the Hebrew slaves from the bondage of Egypt, God had fulfilled the promise which he had made to their forefathers. And this God was now prepared to make a new covenant with them as a people, even as he has made a covenant with their ancestors individually, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But before this accomplishing God, this Yahweh, would make such a covenant with them, they must first commit themselves to a way of life acceptable to him. They must accept a new discipline. They must pledge themselves to resist the ways of the heathen, their idolatries and their immoralities. Yahweh, Moses told the people, was a very exacting God. He was an El Kadosh, a holy God. He will not tolerate the worship of any other gods. He is Elkanah, a jealous God, not in the sense of being jealous or envious of any other God. No other gods existed of whom he need be jealous. Yahweh is the only God, but he is intolerant of those who would persist in worshiping other gods alongside of him. He demands of his people, whom he had especially chosen, not alone an exclusive devotion, but a career of relentless opposition to the worship of other gods. You shall worship no other god. You shall tear down their altars and break their pillars and cut down their asherim. This is a new note. The patriarchs were monotheists, but not militarily so. They were not iconoclasts. Now this intolerance of the worship of other gods and of the making of images should not lead us to the hasty conclusion that the God to whose worship Moses summoned his people was a stern, inexorable being, a tyrannical ruler, a relentless judge, as some have sought to give the impression. At Sinai, Yahweh revealed himself to Moses as Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum, V'chanun, Erech Apayim, V'rav Chesed, V'emes, Notzer Chesed Lo Alafim, Nosei Avon, V'fesha, V'chata'a. Yahweh, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in mercy and faithfulness, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. Forces of nature, whom the ancients worshipped as their gods, forces of nature are relentless. They cannot change. But Yahweh is not a force of nature. He is the God of nature and of man. He can forgive and change and heal and redress and redeem. He made known his ways to Moses. As a father pities his children, so Yahweh pities those who revere him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. Moses was the first religious teacher of mankind who rejected the attributes of the dreadful, the implacable, and the incalculable, which the ancients so frequently ascribed to their gods. He taught his people to think of Yahweh, the sole God of the universe, as the compassionate, the loving, and the forgiving. In the eyes of the Jewish people, Moses never figured as the stern figure. They thought of him as the Raya Nehemna, the faithful shepherd. He was a kind and loving shepherd of his people. Along with this new note of active opposition to polytheism is the thoroughgoing prohibition against the making of graven images for purposes of worship. Moses did not prohibit the making of images. He prohibited the making of images for purposes of worship. Because the image often becomes a substitute for the idea and often distorts and displaces it. An idea which is represented in a material form may lead to moral aberration. Thus, the attempt to represent God as the creator in physical imagery and ritual led to phallic symbols and to the cult of sacred prostitution among the religions of antiquity. But to think of God abstractly, inwardly, in terms of attributes of life and love, of goodness and justice and mercy is to stir man's inner life to move in these very directions. An imageless God inspires resourcefulness in the spirit of man and enhances the vitality of the inner life. Man becomes self-driven to explore the abstract idea to its ultimate conclusions. The awareness of a great spiritual truth compels a man to go in quest of the source of that truth and to seek new revelations from the God who hides himself. He who thinks of the spirit spiritually must forever go beyond. There's an eminent philosopher who declared that the keynote of idolatry is contentment with the prevalent gods, symbolizing idols. Now Moses instructed the people whom he led out of Egypt that the way to worship this one imageless God is through a life of holiness. For God is holy. Not through sacrifices or magic or mere ritual and ceremony, but through justice and love and charity and brotherhood, through the love of one's neighbor, through the love of the stranger, through reverence for the aged, by honoring one's parents, by not bearing false witness, or hating, or taking vengeance, or oppressing, or exploiting the poor and the weak. Now, some of these ethical ideas were not unknown in the ancient world. Moses didn't actually invent them. No great religious leader of man invented new ideas. The roots of moral beginnings are generally hidden and very difficult to trace. The uniqueness of the Mosaic Torah resides in the fact that these and other exalted ethical ideas were made by him peremptory, divine mandates, the essentials of faith, and the only true way of worshiping God. Moses set ethical values fast in the religious life of man. They became an integral part of religion, postulates of theology, and thereafter, and for all time, remained an inseparable part of true religion, which was not the case of any of the religions of antiquity. And so a new synthesis and orientation was thus achieved for the spiritual life of man, a bold new design, a major shift of emphasis away from the magical and the mythological, the purely ritualistic, and towards the ethical and the humanistic in religion. That was a breakthrough for mankind. Moses was resolved to make of this motley crowd of slaves whom he led out of Egypt a people, and a different kind of a people, a unique people, an Am Segula, one that would be bound eternally by a covenant to a spiritual and ethical life purpose, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, he called them, which would be forever dedicated to a new faith, a new mode of worship, and a new way of life. Now, where are these fundamental teachings of Moses to be found? What was this original Torah which he gave to Israel? What parts of the Pentateuch of the so-called five books of Moses can actually be traced to him? Well, now the Decalogue, or the 10 words, the Aseret Hadibrot, the 10 commandments as we call them, are in all likelihood part of the original Torah, though not necessarily in their present form or order. The Decalogue contains fundamental teachings of a universal moral character of high generality, precisely the kind of doctrine that Moses, intent upon fashioning a new society of free men dedicated to the worship through righteousness of the one unseen and unrepresented God, would announce to his people. There are no ritualistic laws in the Ten Commandments. Only one, the Sabbath. And it's my conviction that Moses actually established the Sabbath as an institution in the life of the people to symbolize the freedom of man. The slave did not rest one day a week or one day a year for that matter. He was a beast of burden. Moses, who brought the people out of slavery to create a new life, wanted that life to be symbolized by a day of rest for master and slave alike. Otherwise, the Decalogue contains no prescription, no observances, no call to follow any ceremonies. They're ethical teachings of a universal character. But the Decalogue is not the whole of the original Torah. It was not intended to be complete and all-inclusive. It is an excerpt of the original Torah. It was a common practice in ancient times to make short excerpts or epitomes out of larger codes for special purposes. And ten was a common type of arrangement. Groupings of ten were both convenient and an aid to memory. But there are other words, devarim, of the same character as those of the Decalogue, which are found elsewhere in the Torah. And they are found in the three codes of the Torah. The first code is known as the Book of the Covenant, found in the book of Exodus, chapters 20 to 23. The second code is the so-called Code of Holiness, found in chapters 19 to 26 of the book of Leviticus, the third book, beginning with that famous sentence, "Ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy," and containing that remarkable summary of religion, the Ohavta l'reacha kamocha, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And the third code is found in the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of Moses, chapters 5 to 28. And taken together and making due allowances for later editing and for accretions, the words, the devarim, which are found in these three codes, constitute, in my judgment, the original Torah of Moses. Now then, how shall we characterize these words as a whole, this original Torah of Moses, from which all else in Judaism later developed? And with that, I close. There's much else. Who was this Moses? What was his background? How did the great religious reformation of the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten of the 14th century influence Moses? Whom did Moses lead out of Egypt? What group of tribes? The tribes of Israel or the tribe of Judah, or both? And how did his Torah fare after it was brought into Palestine? Who fought it? Who championed it? The whole story of its, the struggle of this Torah to survive, that is found in other parts of the book, which you'll have to read. But I want to close with this general characterization of the words of the Torah of Moses. There is little of formal theology in these words which constitute the original Torah of Moses, other than the two foundation doctrines of the faith, the unity of God and the prohibition of images. Otherwise, there's little of formal theology in anything that Moses taught. There is no doctrine there of inherent human depravity and of the need for atonement or redemption or salvation. The sorrows and despairs of the world are not dwelt on, and no way of escape is offered from the trammels of existence, as you find in some other of the great religions of mankind. There are no magical formulae here by means of which to constrain the deity, nor any technique of divination by which to ascertain his will. Nothing is said in the Torah about pre-existence, reincarnation, transmigration, a judgment day, resurrection, or immortality. No Messiah is promised, no world renewal, no future age, and no kingdom not of this world. Here are clearly indicated in this Torah of Moses, the original Torah, the core of the Torah. Here are clearly indicated ethical guideposts pointing the way towards a sound and orderly way of life for the individual and society. Here are standards of behavior which do not transcend the limits of man's powers. For this commandment which I command you this day is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. But while mindful of the frailties of man and of the pitiless impediments of his life on earth, demands are nevertheless made in this Torah upon man, and goals are set for him which call for unremitting spiritual effort and aspiration towards the good life and the good society. This is the original Torah which Moses set before the children of Israel according to the command of Yahweh, a Torah of monumental simplicity, of lucid clarity, of great depth, but of no mysteries. This is the Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, Torah which Moses commanded us, Morasha Kielat Yaakov, which has become the inheritance of the whole congregation of Israel and the goals, the religious goals of mankind.